You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the US President reminds the Saudi King of the importance of human rights and the rule of law. We'll examine a shift in tone between the two nations, just as a report is expected to implicate the Saudi heir Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Also ahead this hour, why Denmark could be looking at a so-called summer of joy as its COVID vaccination programme is rolled out at top speed. Our Hong Kong bureau chief will assess the impact of the UK's offer of safe passage to those wishing to flee the increasingly tight controls by Beijing. And Andrew Muller is here with his weekly recap of the world's strongest moments.
We learned that despite nearly a year now of widespread Zoom-induced unkemptness, at least one institution remains doggedly determined to uphold sartorial standards.
Plus, we'll also look forward to a trip on Austria's sleek new night trains. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Greece and Austria have called on the EU to adopt so-called coronavirus vaccination passports. The Armenian Prime Minister says his country is under threat of a military coup, as he said he and his cabinet have been told by the armed forces to step down. And the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been moved from a Moscow jail, possibly to a prison camp. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the US President Joe Biden has spoken by phone with King Salman of Saudi Arabia as the White House resets the relationship between Washington and Riyadh. Ties between the two countries had become significantly closer during Donald Trump's time in office. But this has been further complicated by matters following the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. A US report due to be released shortly is expected to implicate the King's son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Well, for more, I'm joined by Bill Law, a Middle East analyst and editor of Arab Digest and a regular voice on Monocle 24. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Emma.
Let's examine straight away, what do we know that was in this call between the US president and the Saudi king? Issues that perhaps Saudi doesn't really want to talk about.
Well, actually, what's interesting about the call is that the president touched on three issues. One was human rights, and he specifically singled out Jane Al-Hathloul, the women's rights activist who has been released from prison but still has severe restrictions on her. The second is the war in Yemen. The Americans have made clear that they want this war to end. And the third was security, reassuring King Salman that America has Saudi Arabia's back. And of course, that is important, particularly given the situation with Iran and Mr. Biden's desire to return to the JCPOA. And interestingly as well, his Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, was on a conversation with his counterpart, Faisal bin Farhan, the Saudi Foreign Secretary, and he said pretty much the same thing. He didn't mention the Jane Al-Hathloul, but he talked about human rights, he talked about Yemen, and he talked about security. So the question is are these attempts to reassure as well as to press on the fronts that Biden wants action on? Or is this basically setting things up for this report that will be released and appears to be naming the king's son, Mohammed bin Salman, as instrumental in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi? Everyone waits, and most of all, I think the Saudis are holding their breath. I think that in terms of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, look, Saudi Arabia is a key ally in the Middle East for America. I don't know that Biden wants to push very, very hard in terms of doing down Mohammed bin Salman, as some have suggested. I do think he wants to see some serious behavioral changes, and he's using the issue of human rights as a way of achieving that end.
There's lots you've just said which is worth exploring, Bill. Let's deal with the Jamal Khashoggi report, which is imminent. I think we were expecting it within the next few hours and days at least. Is anybody going to be desperately surprised about the implication of Mohammed bin Salman, given the fact that the killing of the Saudi journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018 was always seen as a highly organized mission coming from the top?
No, I don't think anybody will be surprised. I mean, it's been considered a hard fact that Mohammed bin Salman is ultimately responsible for the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And I think that is certainly the conclusion of the CIA. It's the conclusion of British intelligence, other intelligence services. It's certainly the conclusion of the Turkish intelligence service. So I don't think that there's going to be a surprise. The only surprise would be if the report was released and Mohammed bin Salman's name was redacted. But that would be rather pointless, you know, to release the report and block out his name. It's an interesting situation. I think that, Donald Trump had boasted that he had saved Mohammed bin Salman's ass, and Donald Trump is gone. Joe Biden is not in any way interested in that sort of approach to foreign policy. He looks at Mohammed bin Salman and sees him for what he is, which is a very reckless, callous young man who's made numerous blunders, not least of which, of course, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but engaging in the war in Yemen, which he thought was going to be a very quick win for him, the seizure of Saad Hariri, the Lebanese prime minister, the jailing of Loujain Al-Athloul and other female rights activists. The list goes on, as well as his obsession with these very expensive mega projects. When what Saudi Arabia needs is jobs for its increasingly huge youth population and affordable housing for young Saudis. So, I think that Biden is a radically different approach, and the Saudis are going to have to adjust and adjust quickly.
There was an adjustment very soon after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, wasn't there, that the whole world looked at Saudi Arabia as a pariah. That seemed to soon fade, didn't it? We then had the resumption of almost normal relations with Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Western world. Did the Khashoggi murder fundamentally change things, or is it just something along the way that would be consigned to an unpleasant moment in history, an absolute tragedy for the Khashoggi family? But when it comes to the way that the world turns, it didn't change much.
Well, that's a very interesting question, Emma. I think that, had Donald Trump remained president, then, yeah, probably it would have gradually slipped away. Although, the family that is not the Khashoggi family, which has basically accepted money and stopped and become quiet about the killing of Jamal, but his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, has continued her campaign. Certainly the Washington Post has continued its campaign. So that was going to continue. What's accelerated it now and brought it back into the world domain, if you will, is this report. Now, once this report is out, how damaging will it be? Saudi Arabia is very attractive in many ways to business interests because it's a big market. Mohammed bin Salman has carried out some radical economic reforms that are attractive to Western business. At the same time, business looks at some of these mega projects that he's launched into and wonder, is it a good investment? Sadly, I think when push comes to shove, human rights is bumped back down the ladder again. What's interesting, however, is that human rights, these things come and go in cycles. And right now, Biden has put human rights on the front foot. So there is this opportunity now. It depends how he plays it for various people in prisons throughout the world. But I focus on the Middle East to release these prisoners of conscience in the United Arab Emirates, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, and this is probably the time when Biden needs to push on that front. As I say, whether it's a card that he's playing pragmatically, simply to affect behavioral change, or whether he is seriously committed to human rights as a major part of a fresh American agenda. I think we'll just have to wait and see on that one.
What about other nations which are tied very, very closely to this ally between this alliance between the US and Saudi?
Yes, well, that's interesting. I mean, the UK here remains very, very quiet on this front, certainly on the human rights front. We're not hearing anything there, and nor have we for many years. Europe will push a little harder. Europe has got a better record. The EU has a better record on human rights. And certainly the sense in Europe is that Mohammed bin Salman needs to be held to account, needs to be brought to heel. There's the appetite for that in America, in Washington. I don't think there's the appetite here in London for a similar stance. And that, of course, is tied to the arms deal, our need for deals post-Brexit with the Gulf states. The Gulf states, of course, have many, many investments right here in London in terms of property and other things. So, yeah, the quiet here, I find, you know, being a colleague of Jamal's, disheartening, but not surprising.
Bill Law, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24.
Monocle's March issue is all about doing it better as we look at the entrepreneurs, designers, and corporate giants dedicating themselves to the task of improving how we live, shop, and work. Let's dive in.
Doing it better in the Japanese hospitality game has always been the order of the day for Chef Shin Harakawa. His new rural restaurant celebrates the best of local produce and heirloom plants in a burgeoning Japanese town.
So, what are you waiting for? Order a copy of Monocle's March issue today or subscribe to get instant access to our digital editions.
If you've just joined us, welcome. This is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. We're live on Monocle 24 from Studio One here in London. The time's just gone 7:12 here in London. Now, could Denmark be one of the few European nations to enjoy a so-called summer of joy this year? The vaccination programme is racing ahead with some of the highest rates in the European Union. Meanwhile, leaders of the EU's 27 countries are meeting to discuss the pandemic, and the introduction of vaccine certificates is high on the agenda. To find out more, I'm joined by Naomi O'Leary. She's the Europe correspondent for the Irish Times, based in Brussels. Hello, Naomi. Good to have you with us. So just put into context the Danish success story. What's happening?
Yeah, so the aim of Denmark is to have everyone who wants to be vaccinated, who's an adult, done by June 27th. That's a pretty similar aim that Ireland has. Ireland has also the aim of end June, but for 82% of people. Denmark is also counting on vaccines arriving from CureVac, which Ireland hasn't factored in. So basically, they both believe that they can catch up with the UK. That would mean vaccinating a lot of people. So it would mean a very significant national ramp up of giving out the vaccines. Denmark expects it would need to do about 100,000 people a day. And that's really where the test lies now. You know, overall, the EU has bought, I think, 2.2 billion vaccines, enough to vaccinate its population many times over. So really, the question that will decide how quickly the populations are vaccinated now really will be whether governments can ramp up vaccination to get those jabs out to people quick enough. And there's going to be a big difference in national performance because it's harder for larger states to do. And there's just vast differences in things like how keen people are to get a vaccine and national organisations. So there will be quite a, I think, widening differences between the performance of different EU member states going forward.
It also has a highly digitised healthcare system, which, when we come to talking about the vaccine in a moment and the vaccine passports, will mean that things move more quickly just because everything is more efficiently organised.
It's certainly helpful to have a good database. So what Denmark has is it has a digital citizen ID system. It's the same system that is used for taxes, for example, or any communications with the state. And it means that they can literally search for citizens over a certain age in this database and send them a vaccine invitation to a digital inbox, which is the same place where they would get communications about student loans or childcare places or tax. So people are used to using it. then they would be able to attend the vaccine. And when you're looking at the logistics of summoning people once and then calling them back for a second shot, you know, that's really, really important. Denmark isn't extending the time that it between giving people doses like the UK is. I haven't gone for that strategy yet. So at the moment, like what we've seen across the EU is a higher proportion of people have been fully vaccinated now than in the UK, but a lower percentage of people have had a single shot.
Let's talk about the two-day meeting that's being held virtually by the EU leaders to discuss the pandemic. At the top of the agenda has been a push for a vaccine passport, something that the Danes could do pretty quickly because of what you talked about just then, the excellent digitisation of the country's healthcare system. But there seems to be issues, don't there, that between the likes of Austria and Greece, who are saying we need a vaccination passport straight away in order to reopen Europe for tourism this summer, which is absolutely key to so many economies. And yet we have the French and the Germans who are saying, hang on, we're not quite there yet. We can't actually prove that vaccination itself stops transmission of the disease yet. It just proves that you don't suffer severe symptoms. It's still a really difficult area to navigate its way through, but they're moving very quickly on it.
They say that this system can be up and running in 3 months. And what the European Commission has said is they've already given advice to member states about what data they should be collecting for this EU-wide certificate. So there's a couple of things. It's like name, you know, and vaccine status and so on. And if this is uniformly done across member states, they can start it at a national level, then it will be easy to link it up and for it to become an international certificate. There's questions about, you know, one thing is to have a digital proof of vaccination. And then the second question is what rights or extra allowances do you get if you have that? And that's quite controversial. Different member states have very different views on that. It's seen as discriminatory in some member states to discriminate between people who are vaccinated and not, particularly when people don't actually yet have the choice to have a vaccine. It's not something that's under their control. And the other question is that, you know, what the World Health Organization is warning is that vaccines shouldn't be seen as a passport to just do whatever you want, because if that happens, and as soon as the vulnerable are, you know, everything opens up, all the services open up as soon as the older and vulnerable are vaccinated, what we'll have is a rise in infections and an increased risk of new variants, which the vaccines may not work against. And then we could just be into another phase of the pandemic.
It's an interesting situation, though, that the passports seem to be more easily organised and discussed and pushed ahead in terms of the agenda than the actual vaccination programme itself. I mean, last night there was a large amount of frustration being vented by the EU that the delivery of the vaccines and the manufacture of the vaccines weren't going as quickly as possible. And they were having they're being ferociously critical of some of the pharma companies.
The pharma company that everyone's most angry at is AstraZeneca, because they really dramatically cut the anticipated doses that they had said that they could deliver. Many EU countries base their national vaccine programs around those anticipated deliveries, and they were drastically cut to a fraction of what they had been told. And that meant that, you know, that really affected their vaccination plans, and particularly those countries that had bet hard on AstraZeneca and hadn't bought as much of the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna. AstraZeneca is decidedly in the bad books. However, Moderna and Pfizer have increased their deliveries to the EU, so they're delivering more than they said they would. And there's also more vaccines that are expected to come on stream, particularly there's high hopes in Johnson & Johnson from the United States, because it's a one-shot vaccine, and also CureVac down the line. All in all, there will be enough vaccines for everybody. It's just a question of when do they arrive? You know, the EU has block-booked an enormous amount of the world's supply, so much so that, you know, international health authorities are saying, can you please give vaccines to others? Because at the moment, you know, you're hogging the supply.
Naomi O'Leary, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, Andrew Muller fills in the news gaps with what we learned, with a focus this week on art.
We learned that The Scream by Edvard Munch, the Norwegian painter who is renowned worldwide as the archetype of the despondent nihilist, except in Norway, where he is still recalled as the absolute life of the party, has hidden depths.
Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
/8:22 in Paris, /7:22 here in London. All this week on The Globalist, we've been looking at the impact of a new visa scheme that would grant British National Overseas or BNO passport holders in Hong Kong a pathway to British citizenship. Well, in the final of our series, let's hear from James Chambers, Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief and Asia Editor. Good morning. Good afternoon, James, I should say.
Morning, Emma.
Good to have you with us. Just explain to us, just recap briefly how the scheme is working and whether indeed it is working.
Yes, this scheme was introduced at the end of January, and it allows Hong Kongers with a BNO status to apply for a new kind of immigration route to move to the UK and then end up after 5 or 6 years getting citizenship. So in a sense, it makes it easier for millions of Hong Kongers to move from Hong Kong to the UK. The big development recently was that the UK launched an app earlier this week to make it even easier to apply. So you no longer need to turn up in person. The UK government have announced that thousands of people have already taken advantage of this, and it is going to be assumed that this app will make it even easier and more popular. The app was, I think, number two in the Apple Store this week in terms of most popular downloads, just behind the government's contact tracing app. But I checked today and it's been pipped into third place by the McDonald's home delivery app. So people are looking to move to the UK, but I think their main focus right now seems to be eating out again.
Or their lunch. Indeed, we looked, though, at the change in approach, therefore, when it comes to getting this application process up and running, because up until now, you had to go and sort this out in person, didn't you? And there were understandable fears, many were saying, that the minute that you appeared publicly wishing to try and take advantage of this British scheme, then the authorities obviously knew what you were up to.
Yes, there's a lot of paranoia right now in Hong Kong because of the national security law that was introduced last June. Whereas when the scheme initially launched, you had to go to the British Visa Centre in North Point to take your documents and apply. Now you can have a lot more privacy and do it from your own home. So it'll be interesting to see how many people are actually applying through the online digital route. We'll have to wait for the UK government to give out those figures. But I guess the initial numbers, the few thousand that the UK government have confirmed have already taken advantage of this scheme, it doesn't really tell us much because we are in the middle of COVID-19, and so deciding to move countries, deciding to pick up your life and pack up your home and move all your family to a new country, is something you probably might not want to do in the middle of a pandemic. So while this has just been launched, I think we need to wait a few months, even a few years, to see how popular and how in demand it is for people in Hong Kong. The UK government have estimated they expect about 300,000 Hong Kongers to take this scheme up over the next 5 years, and that obviously reflects the fact that this is a huge decision for people. It's not like a Myanmar or some kind of a war event where you have to just pick up whatever you've got and escape. People here do have time to make that decision, and I imagine as speaking to a lot of people, that the preparations are being made now. You have estate agents who are in the UK and in Hong Kong, having discussions with a lot of people. You have people, selling their homes and buying homes in the UK, looking for jobs. At the moment, it's the preparatory stage. I think a lot of people will, be ready, I guess, to move when the pandemic situation eases in both places, and it's a lot safer than to pack up your bags.
Tell us a little bit about the logistics. I mean, you talked there about the practicalities of homes, etc., being organised between the UK and Hong Kong. But there's a recent article in the Japan Times that was saying that there is actually a fair amount of disorganisation when it comes to this scheme, and activists are not feeling as if they're being left in anywhere other than in diplomatic limbo.
Well, yes, it's it's a huge, potentially huge scheme that could involve, by UK government estimates, up to over five million people. So they've rolled out the scheme pretty quickly, and obviously there are going to be some wrinkles. So there are some people who have already taken advantage of it and who already are in the UK, and they are complaining that there's no system in place for when they get to the country to help them, settle in and acclimatize. So if our listeners have been able to follow this fascinating series over this last week, they'll have heard, people who have already moved, families who are thinking of moving, and then we had a lawyer yesterday who was a bit skeptical about the whole scheme. So it's kind of covered the whole gamut. But what we have seen from the civil servant John, who's already in the UK, is that it is tricky. Moving countries is very tricky. He quit his job in Hong Kong, is now in the UK, in lockdown, finding it very difficult to find a new job. So it is, just getting the visa has become easier. The whole process of moving to the UK has become easier, but that does not necessarily make it easy once you arrive.
Finally, let's deal briefly with another story that's breaking in Hong Kong, where it has been in the last couple of days, which are more reforms to the electoral system.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is an ongoing, never-ending political reforms at the moment. But as our listeners may remember, last September there was going to be an election to the Legislative Council, the LegCo, and that was suspended because of the coronavirus and delayed until next September or this September coming, and the Pan-Democrats, the pro-democracy, the opposition, stood a very good chance in that election of getting a majority of seats and potentially wreaking havoc and bringing the government down. Now, that obviously panicked the government here. It panicked Beijing. The election was suspended, and it's meant to be happening this September. Now, as we all suspected at the time, Beijing and the government here are going to use the intervening time to basically skew the process again. We had the senior Beijing official in Hong Kong saying earlier this week that Hong Kong needs to perfect its electoral system, or you might say it needs to fix it so that the pan-democrats, the opposition, don't stand a chance in the future of ever getting close to claiming a majority. So that's a kind of a brief summary of what's going on, but we expect to hear more when the Beijing government has its annual two meetings in March, and the upshot will basically be that come September the opposition will find it way harder, I would say impossible, to get so close to taking control of the LegCo.
James Chambers, as ever, thank you for joining us on the line from Hong Kong. It's just 7:31 here in London. Still to come, we'll be heading to the Balkans for a roundup of the news, and we'll be hearing about the marvellous new night trains that Austria's ÖBB is building. But first, a quick summary of some of the other news headlines today. Greece and Austria have called for the EU to adopt so-called coronavirus vaccination passports. At a summit of the bloc's leaders on the pandemic, they said only with a return of free movement will there be a revival of tourism. The idea of a vaccine passport is being resisted by France and Germany, who say there's not enough data yet to show a vaccination stops the spread of the virus. The Armenian Prime Minister says his country is under threat of a military coup, as he said he and his cabinet have been told by the armed forces to step down. Nikol Pashinyan told supporters that the army must obey the people and elected authorities. And the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been moved from a Moscow prison, possibly to a prison camp. His supporters say no notice was given before he was moved. Early this month, Mr. Navalny was jailed for 3 years on charges widely seen as politically motivated. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's Friday, which means we've tasked our contributing editor, Andrew Muller, to go through the things we know today that perhaps we didn't know 7 days ago. Here he is with this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week who was really behind the Capitol Hill riot, which occurred in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Are we using that effect too often? It feels like we could be. And that one? We appear to be drifting from the point. So, we learned that the Capitol Hill putsch might not have been what it appeared. We learned that while it might have appeared a massive collective tantrum thrown by the kind of people who believe that American presidential elections are fixed but American professional wrestling is not, it was in fact a cunning false flag operation intended to discredit the Republican ilk of the senator who spilled these beans, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, where voters clearly prize above all other considerations in a candidate a name which rhymes with the state.
Plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
This is, just so we're clear on this, absolute honking nonsense. But we learn from it that any hopes we might have indulged of conspiracy theory receding from its current regrettable prominence in public affairs appear to have been themselves as wretchedly delusional as the hypothesis of Senator Johnson. If we've decided nobody's counting how often we're thrashing these clips, let's have the agonized gear change one again. Because, and hang in there, this should just about work, we also learn something about the one work of art which most comes to mind when contemplating the current general scheme of things. We're going to interpret that as an answer to the clue rather than a comment on the segue. Yes, we learned that The Scream by Edvard Munch, the Norwegian painter who is renowned worldwide as the archetype of the despondent nihilist, except in Norway, where he is still recalled as the absolute life of the party, has hidden depths.
That blows my mind.
Really? No way. Blow me down.
We only made that clip a couple of weeks back, so that one's probably fine. We learned from new tests on Munch's famous existential daub by boffins at Norway's National Museum that Munch cunningly buried a penciled caption amid the painting's lurid whirls. And we learned therefrom that Munch's estimation of his own work was as follows, as now read in the closest thing Monocle can furnish to a Norwegian accent, i.e. the voice of our Scandinavian anguished desk chief, Finland's own Markus Hippi.
Can only have been painted by a madman.
We did not learn, but have since wondered whether there's more of this kind of thing secreted in the layers of other famous paintings, whether the Mona Lisa's smirk covers, hey, the Borgia's money is as good as anyone else's, or the zigs and zags of Picasso's Weeping Woman occlude I totally only did this for a bet, or folded into the tormented purple cyclones of Van Gogh's Starry Night is the admission, I'm phoning these in at this point. These highfalutin observations will flatter the audience by implying a lofty opinion of their general intellectual calibre. Was I not supposed to have read that out loud? And
high hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars.
We learned that despite nearly a year now of widespread Zoom-induced unkemptness, at least one institution remains doggedly determined to uphold sartorial standards. Hat off, top hat, naturally, to the UK's House of Commons, specifically Deputy Speaker Dame Eleanor Lang, who was emphatically not having it when one MP pitched up via video link to address the chamber while clad in a comfy jumper.
I don't think we do go to Stoke-on-Trent. The honourable gentleman has to be dressed as if he were here in the chamber. So we will not go to Stoke-on-Trent.
In fairness to errant MP Jonathan Gullis, he does represent Stoke-on-Trent, where it is possible to become regarded as a swanky dresser by wearing shoes, but well played nevertheless to Madam Deputy Speaker. We require no such reminders here at Monocle 24, where our broadcasting dress code cleaves still to the example set by the glory days of the BBC. No waistcoat and tails, no microphone.
Tips his hat just like an English chappie.
We're off to polish our spats. This is not a euphemism. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Putting on the Ritz.
Let's continue now with a look at what's making the headlines in the Balkans here on Monocle 24. Joining us is our man in the region, Guy Delaunay. Welcome to the Globalist, Guy. Good to have you back.
Morning, Emma. Morning, all.
Let us begin in Croatia, where the internet is playing around with politicians.
It is indeed. I must admit, this one made me laugh out loud, which isn't often that you get that as a reaction to news in the Western Balkans. But there's a news portal in Croatia, a very popular one, called Index. And it pulled a little gag earlier this week in which it had a pop-up. As soon as you went on the website, there was a pop-up, and it asked you a simple question. Are you a human being? Or the second option was, are you a member of the HDZ party? And if you chose human being, you just got through to the regular Index news page. If you chose I'm a member of the HDZ party, it got you through to a page which aggregated all the news stories about corruption involving HDZ politicians. And do you think this has pleased the government, Emma?
I'm sure they're delighted.
They're not.
I'm wrong, aren't I?
Yeah. The government is, of course, the HDZ party, and they are not at all thrilled. They're calling this hate speech. That's what Prime Minister Andrei Plenković has had to say about it. And they're saying that he wants the moral police to intervene, Emma. Not the actual police, but the moral police to intervene, because he says they would be the first to be up in arms if the HDZ pulled a stunt like this.
I wonder what uniform the moral police would wear, that it would be different from the normal police.
I mean, having heard, you know, Andrew's broadcast just then is about spats and coat and tails and all the rest of it, perhaps that would be suitable.
They're certainly well put together, I know that. Do carry on, Guy, I was interrupting you.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, so anyway, I think this is quite entertaining, really, because Index are totally unapologetic about this. They've said, and I thought this was a delicious quote as well, if the HDZ want to treat us as human beings, they should start acting as such. And pointing out that the only party in Croatia's history ever to be convicted as a party of corruption was indeed the HDZ. And this is quite interesting, really, because over the past few years that Andrej Plenković has been prime minister, he has managed to change the image of the HDZ away from being the nasty party, as the Conservative Party in the UK felt they were known in the early 2000s. And he's managed to make them look somewhat more human. It does seem that this is an effort by Index to remind everybody that while Andrej Plenković might be an extremely presentable face of the HDZ, underneath, a lot of the same people who have done all sorts of corrupt acts are still involved in the party.
Let's move on to a cafe revolution taking place in Montenegro that you want to talk to us about.
I think this is terribly important because the right to drink coffee in the Western Balkans, it's almost as crucial as the right to breathe air. No coffee, no functioning in the Western Balkans. There was this recent meme which was showed the different breakfasts in different parts of the world. And while, of course, in France you've got your coffee and croissant, and in the UK you have your full English, in the Western Balkans it was a Turkish coffee and a cigarette. And so people do not function without it. And in Montenegro, earlier this week, the government decided they were going to reintroduce restrictions which would not even allow the sale of takeaway coffee. And this has caused, according to prosecutors, quite literally a revolution. Because there's a town on the outskirts of the capital, Podgorica, called Tuzi, and the mayor of Tuzi, a guy called Niko Jeloshai, said that we're not going to close our cafes here. We're going to enjoy our coffee and we're going to stay open. And I quote, "If the enemies disturb us, we will have a surprise for them." And that was enough for him to get charged with insurrection. So the police actually came into town yesterday when the cafes were open, arrested a few people, among them the mayor, and they have charged him with calling for resistance.
Do we know what the surprise would have been?
Well, that's presumably what they're going to argue in court. But, those sort of sounds like fighting words, doesn't it?
It does. I'm not going to.
I mean, maybe it was a banana. Maybe he's going to argue it was going to be a banana split or something. But
Who knows? We'll find out, as you say, in court. Let's move to Slovenia with a constant running battle with the media.
Yeah, they're at it again. So regular listeners will be aware that Prime Minister Janez Janša, who is somewhat of the right-wing persuasion, has taken it upon himself over the past year that he's been in office to regularly attack journalists. His favourite term for them seems to be prestitutes. And he has got particular ire when it comes to public service media. And there are two different types of public service media in Slovenia. There's the state broadcaster RTV, and there is a news agency called STA. And towards the end of last year, the government suspended STA's funding. It was told, naughty, naughty, don't do this. Even its own coalition partners joined together with the opposition and passed a bill in parliament to ensure the funding would continue. What's happened this month? The funding's been frozen again. And for his trouble, Mr. Janša has been invited to the European Parliament to talk to one of their committees there that are involved with monitoring the state of democracy in member states.
Right. And what is that going to lead to?
Probably nothing at all. But that's the thing, isn't it? But the European Parliament hasn't got a very large amount of power, as I think most people are probably aware. It's fairly embarrassing for Slovenia. And there's quite a lot of people in Slovenia who are embarrassed that their country is being increasingly lumped in, particularly with the likes of Hungary. People here, including President Borut Pahor, I had a conversation with, I think it's in the latest issue of Monocle magazine, are absolutely mortified that the country is being lumped in with the likes of the likes of Hungary and the regime there. That's not how they see themselves at all. So there will probably be more internal pressure in Slovenia on Janez Janša about this embarrassment of him being summoned by the European Parliament rather than the European Parliament doing anything themselves.
Guy Delaunay, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk business now. The financial analyst and Monocle regular, Louise Cooper, joins me. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Emma.
Tell us about the US stocks, not doing terribly well in the last couple of days.
Yeah, there's been a big, and it's not just US stock market, it's Asia, it's and Europe today as well. And so we've gone, rather bizarrely, from economic collapse, right, to potentially economic boom. So this is what the stock markets do. They look into the future, very far into the future. And what a lot are saying is, look, once everybody's vaccinated, there's been huge amounts of government money poured into the economy. Actually, we think the economy could rebound really quite strongly. And that means potentially inflation. And here in the UK, for example, we had some very strong wage growth numbers this week. So that could mean inflation. And actually, that could mean higher interest rates. Now, that's not what the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said earlier this week. But, you know, often Fed chairs can get a bit behind the curve. But that is what the bond markets, the government debt markets are telling you. And quite significantly, the interest rate on a key US government debt figure went very high this week, suggesting that inflation may come back and interest rates might have to go up. So on the back of that, you saw huge falls in the stock market yesterday in America. So the S&P was down about 2.5%, the tech-heavy NASDAQ down 3.6%, so really big falls. In Asia overnight, again, big falls. So Nikkei this morning down about 3.5%, the Hang Seng in Hong Kong down over 3%, even in Shanghai down about over 2%. And here in Europe, we are at the moment indicated, and the markets in Europe open in about 10 or so minutes, indicated about 1.5% lower. So in many ways, this is like great news for us, isn't it? The economy is going to rebound. We'll keep our jobs. You know, wages will be better. This is all great news, but obviously, you know, not so great news for your pension fund as stocks go down a bit. Oil, for example, on the back of this story about, you know, a stronger economic recovery, oil got to a yearly high overnight as well. So it's all sort of, you know, how quickly the world changes, you know, that the stock markets are selling off because the economy may be overheating, inflation may come back, and interest rates may need to be raised.
It sounds like business as usual. It's rather strange. Let's move on to the European Union. When we mentioned it a little bit earlier on in the programme, the issue of the member states trying to work out how to develop a vaccine passport that will be fair for all. But the economic dependence of these countries when it comes to things like tourism and indeed free movement of people is such that there is a huge amount of urgency here.
Yes, in a five-hour video call, can you imagine the fun of a five-hour video call between the EU's 27 leaders, all speaking in different languages? Is it no wonder that the EU decision-making body can be incredibly slow? But the key to all of this was that the German Chancellor Angela Merkel essentially said in a press briefing afterwards that they all agreed vaccine certificates of some shape and form were needed. EU Commission President said, oh, you know, Google or Apple are offering solutions already to the World Health Organization. If we don't have a European solution, American technology will take over. Not sure she's got that right, actually, given that Bloomberg have spoken to someone at Apple and they said, don't know what she's talking about. But obviously, as you said, economically, this would help massively. The problem, as ever with the EU, is the detail, right? So there's a whole such of things. Is it including just a vaccination? Does it include negative testing? Does it include immunity? What does this digital thing look like? What priorities does it give you for travel or for tourism or for movement? Or what about your data, your personal data and the legalities around that? So this is an incredibly difficult thing to negotiate. Meanwhile, some of the EU's poorest countries, Greece, Portugal, that are so dependent on tourism, their economies are so dependent on tourism, they are on their knees and begging the EU to come up with something quickly.
Finally, let's talk about the EU and movement of people, but from Britain, which has just left the EU permanently, 1 million people have left Britain to move back or to the EU.
So this is clearly an obvious story. Oh, Brexit, isn't it terrible? But actually, if you think about where foreign, predominantly EU workers tend to work, they tend to work in the industries that have effectively been closed entirely since March. I think it's 30% of the hospitality industry, 30% of the workers in the hospitality industry are non-British born, and 20% of those in retail, I think, non-British born. So their industries have been pretty much closed since March, and depending on how they were hired, they may or may not have got the furlough scheme. So having said all of that, clearly Brexit may well have played a part as well. So the issue for the UK economy is that migration has been very good for the UK economy. It's driven economic growth, particularly in London. You've got the demographic problem of ageing populations, and that's not just the UK, that's globally. And it's the first time in 50 years that immigration has actually switched to emigration, that more people have left the country than come into the country. So it does raise huge issues. The real test, though, is when we get out of COVID and the world becomes normal, whether, you know, how many of these workers return, because there hopefully will be jobs for them in the hospitality and retail industry, because hopefully those industries will recover.
Louise Cooper, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, for several years, any lover of a European night train, I count myself firmly among them, will have seen the services they use and cherish slowly chipped away. It didn't pay to run a sleeper between Nice and Rome, for example, or between Salzburg and Dusseldorf, no matter how heavenly the journey. But if there is one thing rail lovers can look forward to post-pandemic, it is a new night service operated by Austria's ÖBB. The Nightjet will be launched next year, and it will be made up of 33 routes which will crisscross Europe while the continent sleeps. And there'll be a brand new train as well. Christian Wolmar is a writer and broadcaster specialising in transport. I'm delighted to say he joins us on Monocle 24. Welcome back to The Globalist, Christian.
Good morning.
So tell us about this brand new service and this wonderful new train. I mean, it's a handsome grey and red liveried Siemens model, isn't it? So just tell us what's happening.
Well, this is a rare good news story for the railways. As you said in the introduction, the number of night trains around Europe has just dwindled because the rolling stock was very old, companies didn't want to renew it, the charges to use the rails was expensive, cross-European travel was difficult for bureaucratic reasons. So it's wonderful news that ÖBB has taken this initiative. It's got a new train which comes with compartments that have showers. There's sort of two classes. There's sort of luxury and very luxury from what I can see about it. I haven't had the pleasure of being on one of these, but the pictures are just amazing. This is going to, I think, really challenge short haul jet travel. I mean, why do you want to go to the hassle of, for example, you know, going out to an airport, all the security hassle, staying overnight in a hotel somewhere, and instead of just travelling overnight?
It has always made that perfect sense to me, I must confess. And this is now a perfect moment for the return of the night train, isn't it? We have environmental concerns, meaning that possibly travelling on a short-haul jet isn't quite as attractive as it once was. And also the need for privacy in cabins. You reduce mixing with other people in an age of COVID.
Yes, there are those advantages. I mean, one does hope, actually, that we will be able to mix with each other anyway in the near future. But it will allay fears. I do have concerns about this, though. I mean, is it really going to be viable? I mean, these are brand new trains. There's a capital cost. There is the charge of running on the tracks because, everything is now different in the rail industry, and it's kind of semi-privatized, and they've separated out the train services from the infrastructure, so you have to pay a sort of a toll when you go on the tracks. Will people be attracted to this? Can they get the right pricing? But overall, if they can do that, I think this is a fantastic initiative, and it's one that the railways desperately need, because as you know, use of the railways has absolutely plummeted. I mean, in this country, in Britain, it's running at 15 or 20% of the numbers that were in 2019. And, maybe this will be a way of inspiring rail travel and attracting people back onto the tracks.
Indeed. I mean, it's a couple of years ago since, I think it's in 2019, that Monocle covered the fact that Urbe Bay was doing so well. I think it had 1.4 million passengers boarding its night jet services every year. There was a sign then that actually you could combine value and comfort, because anybody who's been on a night train, if you go on a Deutsche Bahn one, they're wonderful. You get wonderful wool blankets and cotton sheets, although you do get bounced about and one can never say you're fully refreshed. But is there a sense that actually they could make this system profitable if enough people use it?
Yes, I did once take the train from Mannheim to Leipzig, I think it was, and they forgot to wake me. So I had to rush out on the train. So I hope that sort of service improves. But, you know, this is a different world from the old one. I used to take the ski train very often down from Paris to Bourg-Saint-Maurice in the middle of France. And it was like a rickety old train. It was pretty basic service. There were six people in a compartment and so on. This is a kind of completely different idea. And indeed, in Britain, they've improved the service between London and Scotland with new trains and very much more comfortable compartments. So this is a kind of different product than the old cheap and cheerful one. It's aimed very much at business travellers, I think, and you know, luxury leisure travellers. And I think that is a good market. I think that's the right way of pitching it. And let's hope maybe we'll travel together on one soon, Emma. It would be great fun.
Christian, what a request. I'm blushing. All right, then. So you're in charge of the timetables. Plot me your dream night journey.
Oh, I think I'd like to go I presume from Vienna or from Central Europe somewhere up towards Malmö in Sweden and use that boat. They put the trains on a ship overnight from Germany to Denmark, and that would be great fun, wouldn't it? To start the night in Vienna and end up waking up in the morning rattling along Scandinavia, Denmark, and over that amazing bridge between Denmark and Sweden. Hey, how about that, Emma?
Urbe Bay, I hope you're listening. Christian Warbar, thank you so much for that. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Ribello, Daniel Bache, our researcher, Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager, Maylie Evans, with editing assistance from Christy Evans. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for tuning in, and have a great weekend. We'll